Greetings, and welcome back to a new episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. I apologize for the hiatus. I was involved in a murder case in upstate New York, which took several weeks, all of my time, and I've been getting back on track. So today we're going to do something a little different, a little out of our comfort zone. We're going to turn to a civil matter. It's an area of law that's been in the media quite a bit lately. Civil trials don't often garner huge national media coverage, but for some reason, when the allegation is defamation, the country pays attention. No, we aren't going to be discussing Amber Heard and Johnny Depp just yet. That's potentially in the works, but today's defamation case presents a whole host of really interesting issues in litigation. We're going to explore the fine line between free speech and defamation. We're going to talk about what happens when a lawyer royally screws up, and we're going to discuss perjury, the limits of what a witness can say on the stand and under what circumstances. So, if it isn't Amber Heard defaming Johnny Depp or vice versa, who are the players in this courtroom drama? To understand the significance of this particular case, you need to know a little bit about the underlying facts that the allegedly defamatory statements concerned. On December 14th, 2012, a 20-year-old boy named Adam Lanza murdered his mother. He then left his home and brought a Bushmaster XM15 semi-automatic rifle to a local elementary school in Sandy Hook, Connecticut. He murdered an additional 26 people. 20 of the victims were children. 6 were staff. For me, like many people I know, the Sandy Hook school shooting was a bit like the terror attack on 9/11. I remember exactly where I was when I first heard. I recall a real sense of dread. I was in high school in 1999 when the Columbine shooting gripped national news. And though there have been many, far too many, school shootings between 1999 and Sandy Hook in 2012, this one really hit different. The vast majority of school shootings involve high schools. And while many involve injuries, mercifully, most do not result in fatalities. We did a deeper dive on school shootings when we discussed the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting committed by Nicholas Cruz, so I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on school shootings in general. But in my opinion, Sandy Hook was different. This wasn't a disgruntled high schooler or recent graduate come to take revenge on the cool kids or the kids that bullied him or a teacher who gave him a hard time. This was a 20-year-old who killed elementary school kids. The level of inhumanity required to commit a mass murder of 5 to 10-year-olds is inconceivable. 26 people were killed, but hundreds of lives were destroyed that day. Adam Lanza was not apprehended alive. When first responders arrived at the school, he took his own life. Grief struck a dumbfounded nation. There was an outpouring of support for the Sandy Hook community. In the midst of this horrific and chaotic tragedy, the country really rallied around those who were mourning. People were mourning the loss of sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, spouses, and friends. But then a voice bucked the trend. There was a voice in the ether that wasn't sympathetic, that wasn't struck with grief. One man with a fairly significant following on his YouTube channel began making some wild claims about the Sandy Hook massacre. In short, he said it was a hoax. He claimed the whole event was staged, that everyone involved was a crisis actor, that nobody actually died. He claimed that the government perpetrated this fraud on the American people so that it could impose stricter gun laws and circumvent the Second Amendment. As a result of this person's repeated insistence that the Sandy Hook massacre was staged to further government control over its citizens, some of this man's listeners began hunting down the family members of the kids and staff members who were killed, harassing and threatening them. Vitriol that you could not believe was being hurled at people desperately trying to cope with the loss of a loved one. The events that transpire in this case demonstrate two of the basest aspects of human behavior. The actions of the parties in this case demonstrate quintessentially what happens when certain elements of our nature are pushed to the brink. On one hand, we have insatiable greed. One man, flanked by a cadre of corporations under his control and an army of followers who support his constant desire for more. More followers, more influence, more power, and more money. A man who's willing to dismiss facts as an inconvenience and sell lies because they're more lucrative. He's devoted every aspect of his professional life to expansion at the cost of every virtue humanity knows. On the other hand, is the indomitable human spirit. There's something about human beings that just when a person appears to be at their most broken, they have the ability to summon, through sheer force of will, the strength to fight back. When life has literally beaten a person down to the ground and screams at them to just stay down, give it up, throw in the towel, there is something deeply ingrained in people which simply refuses to lose, refuses to admit defeat, and which draws on a strength that they never knew existed to fight injustice and right some of the most heinous wrongs. This is Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis against Alex Jones. If you've been following the epic fall of Alex Jones and his InfoWars umbrella company, you likely know that he has been sued in several jurisdictions for defamation. We're going to discuss the Travis County, Texas case, because I think it's the most interesting. It was one of the earlier cases, and I think it's a fairly representative situation for how the cases against Jones have gone. As I said before, defamation is typically a civil case, not criminal. So I had to do some extra research because violations of civil law aren't really my typical wheelhouse. And I wanted to make sure I fully understood what I was talking about before I make any pronouncements on this show. So I apologize that between the extra research and the complicated murder trial that I was just involved in, it's been a long time since an episode came out. And I hope that you find this one worth the wait. To start with, let's do a bit of background on Alex Jones. Jones was born on February 11th, 1974, in a suburb of Dallas, Texas. His father was a dentist, and he had his mother, who stayed at home. His childhood was nothing spectacular. He was an average student. Like many boys growing up in Texas in the late 80s and early 90s, he played football. His family moved to Austin during his sophomore year of high school, and he attended Anderson High School. He briefly attended Austin Community College, but dropped out long before graduating. Jones, who is known for routinely espousing off-the-wall conspiracy theories, got his start in extreme views relatively early. In many interviews, he stated that Gary Allen's book, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, had a profound influence on him in his formative years. Gary Allen, for those of you who are unaware, is a conspiracy theorist and member of the John Birch Society. And for those of you unfamiliar with the John Birch Society, it's a right-wing advocacy group founded in the late 1950s, which uses some pretty strong rhetoric to condemn collectivism, communism, socialism, and most political left-wing policies, while extolling a very nativist and virtuous view of what they term Americanism. Americanism doesn't really have any sort of set definition, other than it just opposes all the evils of left-wing thinking. Gary Allen, the author of None Dare Call It Conspiracy, was one of the more extremist members. He was a speechwriter for George Wallace, believed in all sorts of communist and left-wing conspiracy theories. The book basically alleges that all major events in world history from the time of the Bolshevik Revolution onward were engineered by a small group of mostly international banking magnates and the Council on Foreign Relations. It's a complete crock, but it sent Jones on a conspiracy bent. Jones has always been known for using his shows, his various platforms, to spread a multitude of conspiracy theories. Beginning in the 1990s, Jones started forming a following. The siege of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, and the Oklahoma City bombing also had a major impact on him. he developed major conspiracy theories about what was going on. And about this time, he was given a show on public access television in Austin, Texas. He would encourage guests to call in and discuss their views on what the government was doing, blaming unnamed and unidentified individuals and agencies in the government for all sorts of catastrophes. When he was building his public persona and presence, he actually received a number of awards in and around the Austin, Texas area. He received a Best Austin Talk Radio Host Award and built his show up to a pretty substantial regular audience base. But there was a slight problem. Jones would exclusively talk right-wing politics and conspiracy theories. Advertisers didn't really love that. They loved the number of people tuning in, but they didn't necessarily want to have their products advertised right after Jones was claiming that the CIA killed JFK, or that the government orchestrated the Oklahoma City bombing and pinned it on Patsy Timothy McVeigh. When KJFK FM, the radio station that employed Jones for most of the late 90s, found that they consistently couldn't sell advertising spots during his show, they gave Jones an ultimatum. Either expand his range of topics and discuss things that advertisers were more comfortable with, or he would be let go. As we will see throughout this episode, Alex Jones is a stubborn man. He was fired at the end of 1999 because he refused to stop pushing his purely political agenda. After his firing, he set up InfoWars with Kelly Jones, who he was married to at the time. Initially, InfoWars was not a news program. It was a mail order company for videos. Jones had always used his platform for sales as well as pushing his agenda. Initially, it was conspiracy videotapes that he was hawking. Now, he sells natural supplements and a number of other things which he'd been using his show to promote. Aside from InfoWars, Jones set up his own independent broadcast station from his own basement. He filmed and then streamed it over the internet, which was a relatively new medium for this type of production in the year 2000. By the end of the following year, 2001, he was syndicated on over 100 radio stations. Even in 2001, Jones's disregard for the truth and desire to push baseless conspiracy theories was in full swing. On September 11th, 2001, Jones made the claim on his show that very afternoon, when the chaos and mayhem of the day was still enveloping the entire country, that there was a 98% chance that the attacks were government orchestrated by the United States. For years thereafter, Jones would routinely claim that then-President George W. Bush had organized and authorized the 9/11 terror attack. But for all the insanity, for all the blatant disregard for the truth, for all the bluster that had absolutely no substance to back up these ridiculous claims, Jones found an audience. A big audience. He was profiled in the March 2011 edition of Rolling Stone magazine, where it was alleged that his right-wing broadcasts drew larger numbers than mega pundits Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh combined. The Alex Jones Show had moved under the umbrella of the InfoWars company, which was quickly growing into a media empire. There was a website where people could watch clips from previous episodes. There were ways to subscribe and get notified about shows or topics. You could buy any number of merchandise or Alex Jones-themed items from their online store. The company was making lots of money. By 2016, InfoWars programming was syndicated to nearly 130 radio stations nationwide. His daily regular listener base was over 5 million individuals. I've personally been aware of Alex Jones for a long time now. I first heard of him years and years ago, long before Sandy Hook. My impression of him was that he was simply an unserious person who would say anything to make a dollar. I still largely hold that view, but I didn't originally perceive him as dangerous, and I think that was a mistake on my part. When I heard how many people actively tuned in and listened to him, I assumed it was curiosity, novelty, even partially just to ridicule it. It never occurred to me that so many people could actually be buying what this guy was selling. I've always thought that Jones himself didn't believe more than half the things he says, but he knows that if he says them, people will give him money, whether that's from advertising or merchandise or donations or whatever. What he knew, and what I didn't at the time, was that he'd found a following of people passionately and zealously invested in his ideas, who were willing to be led off a cliff if he sent them. I never really appreciated that people took him seriously, because quite frankly, I think I just had too much faith in the people of this country. Listeners may recall the Pizzagate conspiracy theory. For those of you out there who've already been fortunate enough to forget this truly unfortunate series of events, Jones was one of the main purveyors of a theory that Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria in Washington, D.C., was used to house a child sex trafficking ring with ties to high-ranking Democratic politicians. This took place in the midst of the 2016 presidential election and received far more media attention and traction than was warranted. On its face, the theory was patently preposterous. And yet, Edgar Madison Welch, a mentally ill 28-year-old man from North Carolina, made the decision that he was going to save those poor children after listening to Jones. So he drove up to D.C. on December 4th, 2016, and began firing an AR-15-style rifle into the pizzeria. Mercifully, no one was injured. There is no doubt that Jones's show influenced Welch and many others over the years to quote-unquote action. Jones would routinely call for his listeners to investigate and act. In fact, in February 2017, James Alefantis, the owner of Comet Ping Pong Pizza, sent Jones a letter demanding an apology and a retraction for his Pizzagate advocacy. He gave Jones 1 month to put his retraction on his show, where he said he would file a libel lawsuit. Jones apologized to Alefantis on his show and retracted his Pizzagate accusations in March. The Pizzagate situation, to me, is fairly emblematic of really who Alex Jones is. He relentlessly pushed a narrative for which he had absolutely no proof and which was absurd on its face. He conveyed it as fact as opposed to his warped opinion. He encouraged his audience to take steps on their own to look into it, to investigate, and ultimately to right the wrongs he was describing. Then, when confronted and potentially subject to monetary damages for his malfeasance, he backed down, apologized, and retracted his story. That's why I think he cares more about the money than he wants anybody to know. Before we get into the specifics of the Sandy Hook incident, what he said, what his people did, I think it's fair to examine the phenomenon that is Alex Jones within the context of arguments involving free speech. If you've listened to this program's episode on Eugene Debs or Lenny Bruce or many others where censorship or speech restrictions have played a role, you doubtless know where I stand. I am a staunch supporter of free speech. I do not support censorship. I think governmental censorship, regardless of whether the censoring party has a D or an R next to its name, is a bold step towards authoritarianism. I believe the right of people to voice their ideas, to openly debate, to share concepts, and to discuss differences of opinion is the single best way to separate good ideas from bad ones. When you criminalize speech, you are effectively saying, I can't lay out superior arguments, so I'm going to prevent you from being able to get your message out. The marketplace of ideas is necessary to show grotesque ideologies for what they are. The First Amendment prohibits Congress from passing laws which prohibit speech. Congress has not always followed this rule. Legislation like the Espionage Act, passed under Woodrow Wilson to criminalize speech of World War I, is a prime example. The prohibition against the federal government restricting speech was then applied to the states when the 14th Amendment was passed. So the state of New York or the state of Florida cannot legally pass laws which overtly restrict an individual's ability to speak. And many people are quick to point out that free speech is not absolute. The Supreme Court has carved out restrictions to free speech. Chances are at some point you've heard people say that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. This common misconception is based on a phrase given in a 1919 Supreme Court decision, Schenck v. United States. Schenck was then overruled in Brandenburg v. Ohio in 1969, and a whole new test for whether or not speech is constitutionally protected was crafted. In Schenck, the test used for speech was whether it created a clear and present danger to a legitimate government interest. To that end, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who authored the Schenck decision, wrote that you cannot falsely yell fire in a crowded theater and cause a panic. Many legal scholars have argued over the years that even under Schenck, if a theater really was on fire, yelling fire would not have violated the clear and present danger test. It would only be causing a panic when no danger existed, which would be problematic. But again, this is all academic, since in 1969, the rule changed. Yelling fire, falsely or not, in a crowded theater has not been relevant to the free speech debate for over 54 years. It's been relegated to a phrase that people with a modicum of knowledge use to advance the idea that there are certain types of speech, typically the kinds that they don't like, which the government can, should, and rightly does censor. These people usually don't have any idea what they're talking about. Since 1969, the test for constitutionally protected speech has been the incitement to imminent lawless action test. Speech is protected unless it is likely to cause people to imminently break the law. Consequently, like it or not, hate speech is protected. With apologies to the million people on Twitter who were mistaken about this. Insults to political figures are protected. Conspiracy theories are protected. Extreme political views are protected. Lies are protected. What you cannot do is form a crowd, get up on your platform or soapbox, whip them up into a frenzy, and then say, now let's go and burn down the governor's mansion, or attack someone, or loot buildings, or advocate for anything illegal, which, based on the circumstances of your speech-making, is likely to happen. It's important to note that the phrase likely to cause is not just some throwaway line. Speech that advocates for the general overthrow of the American government is protected speech, even though that technically advocates for lawless action, because it isn't likely that that speech, whether it's in front of a crowd of people or written on a pamphlet or however it comes out, is likely to spurn a spontaneous bloody revolution. Also, speech which advocates for the overthrow of the government, in general terms, is not imminent. If a political figure on the campaign trail advocates in front of crowds of thousands to jail a political adversary, even if he were to give completely spurious grounds for the imprisonment, which would make it an illegal detention, if it is not going to result in imminent lawless action, it's protected speech. The law is really designed to prevent people from engaging in rank demagoguery. Unleashing a mass of people after a charismatic leader urges them to take the streets and cause death, destruction, and mayhem. The Supreme Court was trying to balance the ability of people to voice their opinions and position without giving people carte blanche to turn mobs loose on the streets. The likely to incite imminent lawless action test is the most commonly cited of the restrictions on free speech. What really confuses a lot of people is the public-private distinction with the First and 14th Amendment protections. The government, whether that be the federal government or state government, cannot censor speech simply because it does not like what you are saying. That rule does not apply to private business. Twitter, a private company, can block your account if you say something that the company does not like. Free speech has nothing to do with that business decision. Instagram can shut down your account if you say something they don't like. Facebook or Meta can also shut down your account. These are private companies. They are under no obligation to continue servicing your speech if they do not want to. You are not entitled to have your speech heard on a specific corporate platform. But freedom of speech does not mean freedom from consequences. If you spout off hate speech, there is no protection from people calling you a bigot, a racist, a hateful and spiteful person. That's entirely appropriate. You should have your opinions known, but you have to live with the consequences of voicing those opinions. And in the marketplace of ideas, those people who advocate for truly hateful ideologies should be called out for what they are, and subsequently ignored by civilized society. Probably the next biggest carve-out for what can be deemed free speech is defamation. Defamation is nearly always a civil wrong. It's extremely rare to see a criminal defamation case brought. Civil cases comprise well over 99% of defamation claims in this country, though there are states that do have areas of the penal code devoted to defamation. It's just not really used. Usually, defamation is a tort, meaning that it is a civil wrong that one person or entity does to another, which causes some form of identifiable damage, and for which the aggrieved party seeks to be made whole. It consists of a false statement of fact being made and published to a third party, which results in a loss in the defamed person's trade or profession, i.e. economic loss, or causes a reasonable person to think less of them, i.e. reputational loss. Some key considerations to remember. For defamation to take place, there must be an asserted statement of fact. Opinions, which are not facts, cannot be defamatory because they are inherently non-falsifiable. If I pay for ad space in my local newspaper and say, in my opinion, Father Seamus McLaughlin at the local Our Father of a Thousand Pardons Catholic Church is a child molester, and Father McLaughlin is defrocked as a result, I have not defamed him, because I have merely expressed an opinion, and opinions can't be the subject of defamation. Alternatively, if I have firsthand knowledge that Father McLaughlin is a child molester because either I myself was abused or I witnessed someone else's abuse, and I assert factually that Father McLaughlin is a child abuser, and again he loses his job over the assertion, then technically I have not defamed him because the truth is an absolute defense to defamation charges. But proving that something is true can often be difficult. So even if the statements I made were true, I can still technically lose in a defamation trial if I can't prove that they're true. The difficulty is proving it. Often, that is done through a trial, where a jury is asked to decide first whether the statements were asserted as factual as opposed to opinion, and then whether they were indeed false, and second, whether they concerned the plaintiff, and third, whether the statements were published or made to individuals other than the plaintiff, and finally, whether they resulted in economic or reputational loss. As I was doing research on this case, and I was reading about defenses to defamation, I had one question that I'm willing to bet some of you listeners out there are having right now also. Whether a factual assertion is true is not always a pure black and white analysis. Sometimes there's some truth to a statement, even though some aspects of it are false. Sometimes it can be a half-truth. Something can be grounded in truth, but largely fabricated apart from the base premise. So to have a valid defense to a defamation claim, does the statement have to be 100% provably, factually accurate? The answer is, mercifully for journalists, no. So long as there is substantial truth to the statement, you are clear of defamation charges. And again, the person has to know that what they are saying is false for it to be defamation. There's something about human beings that I think inherently wants to give people the benefit of the doubt. Now, obviously, that's not universal. But the average person is typically going to ascribe ignorance or carelessness to falsehoods over willful malfeasance. That's, I think, how we're made. And I think it's generally a pretty positive aspect of humanity. As a society, we want to believe the best in ourselves and others. It's a foreign concept, contrary to our nature, that people would intentionally lie in order to hurt other people. We're a cooperative species. We operate most efficiently when we're in sync. But at the same time, there are people who are inherently selfish, and working cooperatively is great when it benefits them as well, But as soon as working against someone will increase that individual's power, money, reputation, etc., they will do so. That's Alex Jones. That's who he is and has been his entire career. So let's get to what Alex Jones did. After Adam Lanza brutally murdered his own mother, then drove to Sandy Hook Elementary School and killed 26 people on December 14th, 2012, the country was in a collective state of shock. School shootings had happened before and were, as awful as it is to say, not terribly uncommon. But Sandy Hook was different. Up to 2012, the vast majority of school shootings had occurred in high schools by students, and most resulted in injuries without deaths. This was carnage and destruction on a whole new scale. It was young kids, innocent elementary school kids. These weren't bullies who finally pushed someone too far, or a clique of the cool kids who shunned others and forced them down into the AV room in the school basement. These were kids who had recently learned to read, who were practicing multiplication, who hadn't yet garnered enough late experience to really even treat each other badly. As a grief-stricken nation poured its support into this small Connecticut town, a few voices started whispering. Alex Jones may not have been the only person in America who bucked the trend, but he was the loudest, the most listened to, and the most profane. Immediately after the Sandy Hook shoot, Jones made it a recurring topic of discussion on the Alex Jones radio show, which was then under the umbrella of the InfoWars company. Jones is based in Travis County, Texas, which comprises Austin and its surrounding area. He claimed that he personally had dispatched his own investigators on the scene, and that the state police had already gone public that the shooting was a giant hoax. He said the government orchestrated the whole thing in order to push for gun control legislation. He called it a fake, a fraud, a hoax. He affirmatively stated over and over again that it didn't really happen. It's important to note here that Jones was very clearly not offering an opinion. He was stating facts. He stated that he had utilized investigators who had confirmed that this was a fabrication. He stated he knew that this was a government-orchestrated scheme. He didn't use phrases like, I think, or perhaps, or it's my opinion that. He stated again and again that the families of the deceased children and educators who were interviewed were actors playing a role, that no one actually suffered any personal loss. He stated that they were being paid by the government to stoke fears of guns in order to advance an agenda to violate the Second Amendment and take people's guns away illegally. He claimed first responders, police, and EMTs were also actors, and that the real law enforcement agencies were under a gag order, but that he knew some people on the ground who had spoken to him and confirmed that the whole thing was made up. The Sandy Hook shooting took place in December 2012. Jones kept it as a mainstay on his show for years. In early 2013, he was already claiming it was staged. He compared it to the Fast and Furious disastrous arms deal, saying the government was using both in order to restrict gun rights. He relentlessly pushed that he had insider information on the behavior of the parents who lost children when they were off camera, where they behaved as though they were actors. By March 2013, he had begun asserting as fact that the people involved were clearly actors. In mid-2014, Jones hosted several guests on his show who claimed that Sandy Hook was a false flag, and then nobody died. In September 2014, Jones claimed the school was a cutout stage, not even a real place. Jones and an individual named Wolfgang Halbig both stated that they wished Sandy Hook had actually taken place, rather than the truth of it being fake. In January 2015, Jones repeatedly said that one of the children, Noah Ponzer, who was killed at the school, was photographed in Pakistan on January 2nd, 2015, which Jones claimed was proof that the child was just an actor. In March 2015, Jones and Halbig again, who was named as a defendant in other defamation cases involving InfoWars, claimed that they had uncovered information that the school was not even open in December 2014. So throughout 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, and even 2017, Jones relentlessly claimed that the school shooting was a hoax and was staged. He was interviewed on mainstream platforms like Megyn Kelly's NBC News show on June 11th, 2017, where he repeated his position to millions of people, claiming the whole thing was fake. It's bad enough that Jones was making these claims over and over again, but the harm was compounded by the fact that the type of person who's going to really tune in and listen to the Alex Jones show is apparently also the type of person who is more likely to take some sort of action based on what he or she hears. And so some of Jones' listeners took it personally that these quote-unquote crisis actors kept getting interviewed and talking about their grief and pain at losing a child or sibling or spouse. And some of these listeners decided to do something about it. In what is truly one of the worst showings of inhumanity imaginable, these grieving families were subject to harassment, threats, hatred, and vitriol simply for having the temerity to lose a loved one in an act of senseless violence. One family held a charity 5K race in honor of a deceased child, and a man named Matthew Mills came up to Connecticut from Brooklyn and stood in the race path, holding a sign that said, "This never happened." Another family had messages taped to their front door saying they needed to go to church and repent for their lies. Families would routinely get phone calls. They had their addresses and phone numbers posted online with encouragement to call them out. Many people took advantage of that. I can't think of anything in the world worse than losing a child. And the fact that the parents of the Sandy Hook students and the families of the teachers and administrators were unable to properly grieve because Alex Jones fans kept accusing them of making this all up is truly obscene. Obscene and, as it turns out, actionable. By April 2018, Neil Heslin had had enough. Heslin is the father of 6-year-old Jesse Lewis with his wife Scarlett Lewis. Jesse died at Sandy Hook, and Neil and Scarlett were constantly harassed by Jones's followers. He hired the law firm of Castor, Lynch, Farrer, and Bally to file a lawsuit for defamation and infliction of emotional distress against Jones and all his companies. The suit was a big deal and made national headlines. Jones being who he is, he's no stranger to lawsuits, but this one was different. It was high profile. It was in the public eye. Most of the other suits against Alex Jones were not public, and he was able to settle or get rid of them for moderate fines and costs. This was big. The case was assigned to the Honorable Judge Maya Gamble. Initially, Judge Gamble didn't make her own personal feelings on the merits of the case known, as most people would agree is appropriate for a judge. But Judge Gamble began to lose her patience over time. Jones and his corporate entities were represented in all the defamation cases by Norm Pattis and F. Andino Reynal, who immediately denied that Jones had done anything other than exercise his First Amendment right to free speech. In past episodes, we've discussed the obligations of both parties when it comes to discovery in a criminal case. Civil cases work a bit differently. In civil cases, there are things like depositions that occur pre-trial. This is a way for the opposing party to get a statement under oath of any person who may have relevant information to share at the trial. Those statements can then be used at the trial if the witness testifies differently from what they stated in the deposition. In civil cases, also, the parties make specific demands for specific and particular documents and materials from the other side. In the Jones case, Heslin's lead attorney was a man named Mark Bankston. He was helped by Kyle Farrer and William Ogden. Bankston made specific demands for the production of texts and financial and analytics data for the Alex Jones radio show and for InfoWars over certain periods of time that were relevant to the case. Jones never provided the data. Bankston asked. He was ignored. Bankston demanded. He was ignored. He filed a letter with the court, who ordered Jones to comply. Still, Bankston was ignored. And when Judge Gamble's order was ignored, she instructed Jones and his lawyers, Patterson Raynall, to immediately turn over the documents requested, or there would be consequences. Pattis appeared on the Alex Jones radio show frequently during his reputation of Jones over several of the defamation suits, and would routinely talk about his feelings on the judge, on the process, and the suits in general. But at the end of the day, Jones and his legal team ignored all requests for discovery for over 2 years. And when that happens, a judge has a variety of options in response. She can hold the lawyer and the party, meaning Alex Jones, in contempt for willfully violating a valid court order. She had ordered them to turn over the documents. She can issue monetary sanctions against Patterson Raynall and or Jones. She can preclude the parties from introducing certain beneficial pieces of evidence or from calling certain witnesses. And in the most extreme case, she can issue a default judgment for one party, meaning that she would rule Jones liable for defamation without a trial. And that's what Judge Gamble ultimately did. She entered a default judgment. In her order, she took into account that there were several other defamation suits pending before her involving Jones. He was violating discovery orders in all of them. Judge Gamble felt that he was consistently acting in bad faith and needed a rather harsh penalty. A default judgment means essentially that one party is refusing to participate in the litigation, and the judge thereby rules on the entire case in favor of the other party. Default judgments are most often seen when one party files a complaint against some person or some entity, and that person or entity is appropriately served and put on notice that they've been sued, but they never respond. They never hire a lawyer. They never file an answer. They simply choose to pretend the complaint doesn't exist. In that scenario, rather than just wait in perpetuity when nothing is going to happen, the court will enter a judgment in favor of the plaintiff. It's rare to see a default judgment in a case where the defense is, to some degree, active. Judges will usually try and coax compliance with orders using less drastic means. But Judge Gamble had clearly had her fill of Jones. She entered a default judgment for the plaintiffs, and Mark Bankston could not have been more pleased. The only issue to resolve at this point is how to calculate the appropriate damages. There are two types of monetary damages in civil cases: compensatory and punitive. Compensatory damages is the dollar amount to make the person whole again. Let's say that Jesse parks his car on the street near his neighbor Sean's driveway. Let's say that Sean is backing out of the driveway, cuts the wheel a little too hard, and hits Jesse's car. Jesse takes his car to the body shop, and the work to fix the dent costs $300. If Jesse were to sue Sean for the damage to his car, which Sean caused, compensatory damages would be $300. It's the cost to fix or replace the thing that was damaged or destroyed. This is easy to calculate when it's a physical item that's damaged, but as we're going to discuss a bit later, becomes a little more tricky to calculate compensatory damages when you hurt someone's reputation or mental health. You put a dollar amount on that. Punitive damages are exactly what they sound like. They are intended to punish bad behavior. In addition to making someone whole, some actions are so bad that we want to make you pay a little bit more to deter you from doing the thing. Punitive damages usually only come into play when a person is accused of intentionally harming someone or damaging something. If someone is simply negligent or careless, you're less likely to see punitive damages assessed. In the Jones case, as you can imagine, the plaintiffs wanted significant compensatory and punitive damages. In Texas, when a person is found civilly liable for a tort, like defamation, the judge does not simply determine what the damages are. There's a full-on damages trial. Opening statements, witnesses, evidence, closing arguments, the whole shebang. And a six-person jury decides how much money to award the plaintiffs. This is not a criminal proceeding, so a defendant does not have the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. They cannot decline to testify if called by the opposing lawyer. The plaintiffs, Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewitt, testify in gut-wrenching detail about their experiences. Loss, the grief, the constant harassment. Norm Pattis, who very publicly condemned the default judgment while offering absolutely no explanation for the non-compliance with the discovery requests and court orders, understood that the defense role in the damages trial was to minimize damages, not to dispute liability. To that end, his focus was mostly on the amount of time that Heslin and Lewis waited to file suit. His questions boiled down to, if it was so bad, why wait 5.5 years to file a lawsuit? It's kind of hard for me to fault him for taking this line. He really didn't have a whole lot more to work with. Jones himself didn't do any favors during the trial. Let's just take a quick look at his bizarre behavior. After the default judgment, he went on his radio show and called the whole proceeding a fraud. He attacked the judge. He called the lawyers and plaintiffs gun control activists. He actually did not even come to his own trial for the opening statements. Instead, while it was going on, he hosted a radio show about what he called his show trial and further insulted the judge. After the plaintiffs testified, the plaintiffs' lawyers called Jones to the stand, and Jones was not ready for what was coming. Such a huge aspect of trial work is the information that you have. There's an old adage in litigation that during a trial, you never ask a witness a question you don't already know the answer to. Your goal as a lawyer is never to be surprised, to know what the witness is going to say, and to understand how it helps. When there is an information gap, when the lawyer knows something the witness does not, that can be exploited for huge advantages at a trial. If you can lead a witness into certain statements, you can either show them to be lying or at the very least mistaken, and you can shred their credibility in front of a jury. And oh boy, was there an information gap between Mark Bankston and Alex Jones. What Mark Bankston knew and Alex Jones did not know was that 12 days before Jones took the stand, his defense team had inadvertently sent a complete copy of the entirety of his cell phone, all of the data, all of the messages, all of the attachments, all of the browser history, to the plaintiff's attorneys, instead of the very limited section to which they were entitled. This was significant because Jones had been ordered to search his cell phone pre-deposition for certain messages and certain spreadsheets. In his deposition, he had maintained that such messages and such documents did not exist. He swore it under oath. He had conducted a search. He had looked through his electronic devices. They didn't exist. But they did exist. And Bankston had possession of them. And Jones had no idea. Bankston and his team were actually extremely ethical in this situation. They received the full copy of Jones' cell phone and recognized that Raynal had made a pretty significant mistake in turning it over, and they brought that mistake to his attention. Here's Jones' problem. In order to prevent Bankston from using any of the information he received, Jones' lawyers would have to identify some sort of privilege associated with the data and claw it back. This is why it's so important to check and double check anything that you are turning over in discovery. One mistake can be devastating. Information is power in litigation. You need to zealously guard the information you have while posturing yourself to gain as much as you can about your opponent. Once you give information to the other side, even if by accident, it's very hard to legally prevent them from using it. Things that are legally confidential or privileged cannot be used, and ethical attorneys will delete it, or if they refuse, the other party can go to the judge and request that the judge order them to delete it and prohibit them from using it, which a judge will do if the privilege is appropriate. But if you just accidentally turn something over and it's not covered by a privilege, then your opponent is free to do whatever they want with it. In a move that I will never understand, when the error was brought to Reynald's attention, he sent Bankston an email that simply said, quote, "Please disregard," unquote. This is legally meaningless. Reynald then did actually file an emergency motion seeking to force Bankston to delete the entirety of the cell phone content. But Judge Gamble denied that motion because Reynald did not assert any claims of privilege. He simply asked for it to be deleted and acknowledged it was a mistake. When he was later asked how this happened, he said that a paralegal had accidentally sent the entire contents of the phone over and that e-discovery is complicated. It appears that Reynald also did not disclose to Jones that he had sent the entirety of his cell phone to opposing counsel. And this came to a head when Jones was on the stand. Bankston walked through Jones's previous statements about the non-existence of certain text messages and spreadsheets. And Jones reaffirmed, again under oath, that such messages and such documents didn't exist. Bankston then asked Jones if he knew the definition of perjury. Then he informed Jones that he had a complete copy of Jones's cell phone. And he showed Jones the materials from his phone that moments before Jones claimed did not exist, and that he was sure didn't exist because he had conducted a thorough search of his phone looking for them. These types of gotcha moments typically only happen in movies. It's rare that this level of witness destruction happens in real life. When pressed, Jones' response was that he looked, he never found them, and he provided everything he had to his lawyer. He said, quote, "I'm not a tech guy," unquote. He then accused Bankston of lying by claiming that he didn't have the materials and said that there was no need for him to be asking Jones for them since he clearly already had them. It was a fairly pathetic response. It's completely unbelievable, and it makes Jones look like a greedy liar who did not want to admit how much money he had profited off of his Sandy Hook claims. Jones also tried to claim on the stand that it was impossible to quantify how much money he made from the Sandy Hook claims. He claimed that that type of deep analytics analysis did not exist. But it did, on his phone, and it showed that Jones made a lot of money talking about Sandy Hook. The data showed that on some days when Sandy Hook was mentioned, InfoWars took in as much as $800,000. Jones also got himself into a lot of trouble while testifying because the judge specifically instructed him not to protest his innocence in front of the jury. Since liability had already been found, it was inappropriate for Jones to say that he had not defamed anyone or that he was not responsible or liable for any defamation claims. The judge and Jones went back and forth on this several times, with Jones getting more and more testy each time he was told not to make those types of comments. On several occasions, when Jones claimed he did not defame anyone, the judge had to remind him in front of the jury that he had already been found liable, and this was a trial specifically about damages. Calling Jones' testimony on the whole a disaster would be an understatement. He was caught in lies, he was lectured by the judge in front of the jury, he went on long tangents about the supplements his company sells and how wonderful they are. He was combative, he looked very uncomfortable. In a civil trial, The procedure is that the plaintiff's lawyer gives an opening statement, then the defense lawyer gives an opening statement, then the plaintiff puts on his or her case. He calls witnesses, he introduces evidence, he attempts to show that the defendant has done the thing the plaintiff has accused him of, that he's responsible for the wrong or the harm that's been caused. Then the defense has the option to put on the case if he wants to. He can call witnesses on his own behalf. He can introduce evidence, or he can simply make the claim that the plaintiff has failed to establish that he's liable for the actions he's accused of. And again, because this is a civil as opposed to a criminal case, the plaintiff can call the defendant to testify as a witness in the plaintiff's direct case. The defendant does not have the right to refuse to testify. So all of the craziness with Jones's testimony came out during the plaintiff's case. When Bankston and his team rested, Pattison and Raynall had the opportunity to put their own case on. They could have recalled Jones to the stand to testify on his own behalf. And it may not seem like it, but there was merit in doing this. Jones's lawyers did have the opportunity to ask him questions when the plaintiff's attorneys called him, but their questions on cross-examination would have been limited. On cross-examination, a lawyer can only ask questions to the witness within the scope of what was testified to during the direct examination. So if there was extraneous information that Jones needed to get out in front of the jury, he wouldn't be able to testify about it on cross-examination. He would have to come take the stand during the defense case. However, Jones did not testify during his defense case. Instead, he held a press conference on the courthouse stairs and claimed that he was told he would be arrested for perjury for telling the truth about his innocence. He said that the First Amendment rights were being stripped by gun control activist judge. He claimed that this was a kangaroo court and he was refusing to further participate in it. So, he didn't. In a truly bizarre move, he decided not to take the opportunity to introduce any evidence to mitigate what the plaintiffs had claimed the harm was. And during his testimony on the plaintiff's case, Jones got testy when being asked questions about his claims and snapped at Mark Bankston that he'd already apologized to families hundreds of times and he simply wasn't going to do so anymore. He said that in front of the jury. I have to believe his attorneys begged him to retake the stand, issue a formal apology in front of the jury, show remorse, admit he made a mistake in pushing that story, and come up with a plan to do better in the future. That is how he could have mitigated some of these damages. But Alex Jones strikes me as the kind of client who you cannot talk sense to. He's stubborn, he's childish, he's spiteful, and he's frighteningly self-righteous. Convincing him that he actually did something wrong feels borderline impossible. It's easy to look back at litigation once the verdicts and the judgments are in and say, well, this lawyer should have done this or shouldn't have done that. But I remember watching pieces of this damages trial and just wondering if the defense attorneys had any sort of plan at all. It seemed that every day, either Jones or his lawyers were getting mired in some sort of scandal. They looked unprepared, they looked disorganized, and they already looked defeated right from the get-go. It didn't help that Jones himself barely attended the trial. In civil cases, the defendant isn't required to come every day and can be excused. The summations at the close of the evidence phase were exactly what you would expect. Jones's defense was that his particular actions really didn't cause any serious harm, kind of flirting with this idea that he didn't actually defame anybody and he's not liable, but keeping it towards mitigation. And we know that because Heslin waited so long to file a lawsuit. They claimed that he was being hyperbolic and exaggerated the inconvenience to his life, and strongly implied that he was looking for someone to blame for his child's death. So he was taking it out on Jones when really it was Adam Lanza, who should have been the target of his anger. They also claimed, still, that it was impossible to say just how much Jones benefited from his messaging on Sandy Hook because each show talked about lots of different topics, So narrowing down a dollar amount to a segment on the show was simply impossible. Jones had good days, and Jones had bad days, regardless of whether Sandy Hook was discussed. As far as the limited amount they had to work with, it was a fairly coherent and cohesive closing argument. Bankston, however, had most of the facts on his side. He was able to play to the jury's emotions, talking about the pain and the grief Heslin and his wife Scarlett Lewis had been going through since the loss of Jesse. He talked about the harassment, the threats they'd received. He posted the charts he received from Jones's cell phone, which conclusively showed that on the days where Jones spent time talking about Sandy Hook, the revenue generated by InfoWars almost uniformly increased. Traffic to the site increased. Clips talking about Sandy Hook were among the most frequently downloaded. Jones was making millions of dollars by claiming this whole thing was a hoax. There's an interesting tidbit to remember when it comes to damages. States do not cap compensatory damages. Whatever it takes to make someone whole should be paid. A defendant should not get the benefit of harming someone to the tune of $1 million and have the state cap the amount of restitution and compensation to $500,000. You can always collect compensatory damages. Many states, however, do cap punitive damages. There's a fear that juries will become so overcome with emotion that they'll go overboard in punishing someone for behavior that isn't actually criminal. In Texas, there is a cap for punitive damages, and it's at $750,000, absent a very limited set of extenuating circumstances. Patterson Reynal obviously knew this and were counting on the jury coming back with a huge number and that number being reduced to $750,000. As expected, the jury came back with staggering numbers. $4.1 million in compensatory damages. That's what the jury felt would make Heslin and Lewis whole for what Jones had done. $45.2 million in punitive damages. Naturally, Jones' attorneys immediately filed the appropriate motion to reduce the punitive damages down to $750,000 as per Texas state law. The law was passed in 1995, in the last term of the Texas legislature, which was controlled by Democrats seeking to enact tort reform. There was broad sentiment against frivolous litigation at that time. For nearly three decades, that $750,000 number has stuck. I couldn't find any cases where a judge disregarded the law, imposed full punitive damage amounts in excess of $750,000. But Judge Gamble had clearly had enough of Alex Jones. She held a hearing on the punitive damages. The cap at $750,000 is pretty firm, with the exception that if there is an intentional abuse of a disabled person, then the cap does not apply. Jones's lawyers appropriately relied on the clear precedent. They cited cases, they talked about similar cases in the past where damages were reduced, and they asked the judge to follow the law as it's written and how it had been interpreted since its inception for this particular scenario. They discussed how neither Heslin nor Lewis was disabled in any sense of the word. Heslin's lawyers, on the other hand, had little to argue by way of law. What they argued was policy. They essentially said that Alex Jones's conduct was so egregious, so vile, so despicable, that convention shouldn't apply. He should pay the full amount. Punish him for being a dreg of humanity. And they claimed his actions disabled Heslin and Lewis, without really giving much of a thorough explanation of how, but simply that the cap shouldn't apply because they were disabled based on Jones's despicable behavior. When firmly pressed on whether she would follow the law or punish a person she was no longer even bothering to hide her disgust for, Judge Gamble opted for punishment. Her ruling alleged that there may be some constitutional violation by the damages cap, and that the trauma felt for their deceased son counted as a disability. And she held Jones liable for the full $49 million jury award. InfoWars is now in bankruptcy. Jones's lawyers have vowed to appeal. Stay tuned for that. In summation, I have a lot of thoughts about this case. And I know this is already a bit of a longer episode, but I want to share my take on the situation as a whole and on some of the finer points. As a free speech advocate, I am very wary of punishing people for speech. My default position is to be extremely skeptical of any law, civil or criminal, which in some way restricts speech and censors. I think a real representative government, a democracy, needs free speech as a foundation, or it'll crumble. Free speech is the bedrock for every single freedom that we enjoy as a society. But there is a balance to be struck with justice and equality. A person should not be permitted to intentionally lie about other people to reap financial gains at their expense. Expressing one's opinion on matters of public importance is always, and I mean always, going to be protected in my book. But I do agree that when you very clearly assert as fact something which you know to be wrong and which causes serious harm, you should compensate the person you've harmed. And in some cases, you should make punitive payments. Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis just wanted to be left alone to grieve. They didn't seek Jones out. They didn't provoke him. They didn't do anything at all which would impute any partial liability for this mess. What Jones was doing was not engaging in free speech. He was trampling on the rights of families of the Sandy Hook victims. Heslin and Lewis had a right not to be harassed, a right to live their lives without fear that some lunatic Alex Jones fan is going to post their contact information on a message board or wait for them outside their home and accuse them of being crisis actors staging the worst event of their entire life. They had a right to be left to grieve. Alex Jones violated that right with reckless abandon for money. Had Alex Jones hosted the Alex Jones radio show and simply said, "Look, I don't have all the evidence yet, but in my opinion, this thing was all a big hoax concocted by the government to engineer the seizure of everyone's gun," that would have been fine. That's an opinion. He made up facts. He lied. He claimed unnamed sources with firsthand knowledge had confided in him. He made up agreements. He assigned roles to certain people. He intentionally led people astray and ruined people's lives, violating their rights to make money. That is not free speech. Now, a bit about the lawyering here. This is just my position, my opinion. But if you aren't kept up at night in the weeks leading up to a trial, worrying about every little potential thing that could go wrong, or that you aren't absolutely certain will go the way that you want it to, and you're not doing it right. There is no such thing as over-preparation. There is no such thing as over-planning. There is no such thing as over-analyzing. The absolutely worst disservice you can do a client is not take the necessary time to prepare for a trial. If you don't, I guarantee you will miss something, some detail, some aspect, some novel argument that would have helped you. Further, you will make unforced mistakes, like not checking over the discovery that you send to opposing counsel to make sure it's limited to what they're entitled to. You will miss arguments your opponent is going to make, which you can actually counter. At every stage of this, Pattison Reynal seemed unprepared, like they just hadn't bothered to do the work. I don't like to Tuesday morning quarterback other attorneys too much, but it almost seemed to me like they had just given up on the damages trial and were simply going to rely on the cap reduction to $750,000. That they knew that nothing they could say or do was going to keep the punitive damages under that amount, so they just kind of threw their hands up and said, "Well, Texas will just reduce it for us." If, and I acknowledge it's a big if, because I truly don't know what's going through their heads during the lead up to this trial. But if that was their plan, then Judge Gamble's decision shows why you can never, never take anything for granted in a trial. You just cannot. You prepare for every contingency to the best of your ability. You agonize over decisions that should be grounded in law. You prepare memos on statutes and case law on topics that you think will come up. You outline, write out legal arguments ahead of time on the off chance that they pop up. In trial work, you can never sit back and rely on other people to just do what you expect them to do. That being said, I am a bit concerned about Judge Gamble's actions here. And before you all send me hate mail and tell me I'm an ogre, hear me out. Is Alex Jones a bad person? Indisputably. Did he defame Neil Heslin and Scarlett Lewis? I believe Heslin and Lewis would have won at a liability trial, even without the default judgment. The answer is yes. Should Jones have to pay Heslin for what he did? Without a doubt. Was Judge Gamble right to throw out punitive damages cap and hold him liable for the full $49 million? On that, I am not so sure. To soberly examine whether this was legally the right thing to do, we have to take our personal feelings about Alex Jones out of the conversation. We need to examine from a rational perspective and say, look, if this wasn't Alex Jones, if this was just some generic person, would we still feel the same way? Would we still feel that the cap shouldn't apply? Would we determine that Heslin and Lewis were disabled? I'm not so sure we all would. It's easy to rally against bullies. It's easy to cheer when they're kicked off their thrones. But do bullies not deserve equal treatment under the law? That's a hard sell for me. I'm not sure I'm buying the argument that the plaintiffs in this case were disabled in the way contemplated by the law as it relates to the punitive damages cap. Trauma can certainly be disabling. But I reviewed the testimony by psychotherapist Michael Crouch, who discussed the impact on Heslin and Lewis. And I'm not sure that I would consider either of them disabled as a result. Certainly traumatized, re-traumatized even. But a big part of me feels that the real spirit of the law was set aside here in order to simply do what the judge wanted to do and punish the bad guy. And I see this far too often in my own practice, where my client has done something admittedly unsafe, and a judge will bend over backward to warp or twist a law or statute in order to put my client into a category of offender who can receive a harsher penalty. I don't consider that justice. We may not like that there's a punitive damages cap, but like it or not, it's there. And it's not up to judges to find creative ways to circumvent it. If we want carve-outs for this type of egregious behavior, that's a question for the Texas state legislature, rather than inventing disability. We may not be bothered by its imposition on Alex Jones, but the next person to be subject to it might be slightly less odious. And the third person might be close, but a little less offensive, too. And this new novel legal theory could warp the intention of the cap down the line. To wrap up, Jones has been found liable in every one of the Sandy Hook defamation cases, both in Texas and in Connecticut. He and his company have been hit for roughly $1.5 billion in damages. And that's the story on Alex Jones, a man who, in all honesty, probably did get what he deserved. He is no scion of free speech. He's a greedy snake oil salesman who will intentionally lie and ruin people's lives to make that almighty dollar. Special thanks, as always, to Dan Townsend, who edited today's program, and who is again absconding to Europe and taking extra time to do his work for me. It's lucky he's my brother. Thank you, listeners, for your support of the now 51 episodes of In Summation. I really appreciate the insightful comments I get and the discussions they generate. Please keep the comments flowing. And always, feel free to push back on anything that you disagree with, or let me know if you thought something was well articulated or poorly articulated. If you want to get in touch with me to suggest a topic or case, or if you just want to ask a question about criminal law, or if you want to send me a message unrelated to the show, please feel free to email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at insummation. You can visit the show's website, insummation.com. The show also has a Facebook page, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. As always, I appreciate the thoughtful messages I get and the discussions that they generate. And I always, always, always try to be good about responding as quickly as I can. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe to the show and rate and review it. It'll help other people find it as well. If you're new, please check out the entire prior catalog. Today's episode was, again, a little bit different because it was a civil case and I almost exclusively do criminal cases because that's my practice. So, if you enjoyed this episode, you will enjoy much more me talking about topics that I know way more about. I love getting feedback, and I love interacting with people who tell me that they enjoyed some episode or that they learned something new. It really brightens my day. So please reach out if you feel the need to. And as always, thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.